everyone who loves books. This is Read on RNIB Connect Radio.
Hello and welcome to Read On, the audiobook show recorded at the RNIB Talking Book Studios. I'm your host, Red Sale, and this week, as the Booker shortlist has just been announced, we're taking a look back to some past winners. Coming up, Marlon James, George Saunders, Richard Flanagan, Paul Beattie, and Eleanor Catton. That's all coming up in today's Read On. The shortlist for the 2019 Booker Prize has been announced. It is Margaret Atwood for The Testaments, Lucy Ellman for Ducks, Newburyport, Bernardine Evaristo for Girl, Woman, Other, Chigozie Obioma for An Orchestra of Minorities, Salman Rushdie for Quixot, and Elif Shafak for 10 minutes 38 seconds in This Strange World. And listen out for interviews with hopefully all of those authors coming up in future episodes of Read On. But for today, producer Robert and I thought we'd cast our ears back over some interviews with past winners.
And first up, well, it's not really an interview. We got five of the six people on the shortlist last year. One of them didn't like to give interviews, and guess which one won. This is Red's review of Milkman by Anna Burns.
Milkman by Anna Burns is set in an unnamed city, populated for the most part by unnamed people, where to be interesting is dangerous, even deadly. Middle sister, the protagonist, is busy trying to keep her head down, usually buried in a book. And she's intent on keeping her mother in the dark about her maybe boyfriend. But when first brother-in-law starts spreading gossip about her encounter with Milkman, a prominent local paramilitary leader, life for middle sister begins to get rather too interesting for comfort.
The day Somebody McSomebody put a gun to my breast and called me a cat and threatened to shoot me was the same day the milkman died. He had been shot by one of the state hit squads, and I did not care about the shooting of this man. Others did care, though. And some were those who, in the parlance, knew me to see but not to speak to. And I was being talked about because there was a rumour started by them, or more likely by first brother-in-law, that I had been having an affair with this milkman, and that I was 18 and he was 41. I knew his age not because he got shot and it was given by the media, but because there had been talk before this, for months before the shooting, by these people of the rumour, that 41 and 18 was disgusting. The 23 years difference was disgusting. That he was married and not to be fooled by me, for there were plenty of quiet, unnoticeable people who took a bit of watching.
Milkman, written by Anna Burns and narrated by Brid Brenn, is TB24450. The unnamed city closely resembles Belfast in the late 1970s, where Burns grew up. However, it could be any town riven by sectarian violence. It's a hair-trigger society where paranoia rules every aspect of daily life, right down to which brand of butter you buy. Individuality is suspect, speaking out against your elders and betters unwise, and questioning the prevailing orthodoxy is likely to put you beyond the pale and in the way of severe punishment. Against this background, 18-year-old middle sister has little hope of withstanding the unwanted approaches of Milkman, who's old enough to be her father. But although the subject matter is deadly serious, Milkman is also a darkly funny novel, full of gallows humour and characters with all too familiar foibles. Like all good satirists, Anna Burns, who prefers not to give interviews, holds a distorting mirror up to the darker side of human behaviour to mock and reform it. And so she raises her very individual voice against sectarianism the world over.
Thanks for that. That's Red Sale's review of the 2018 Booker Prize winner, Milkman by Anna Burns.
Now, as will become apparent over the next few interviews, Robert has an uncanny knack of managing to interview the winner. So, back in 2017, it was Lincoln in the Bardo by George Saunders. He told Robert about the book.
It's a novel, and it all takes place on one night And the idea is based on an anecdote I heard many years ago, and the anecdote is this. Abraham Lincoln, when he was president during the Civil War, lost his son. His 11-year-old son died of typhoid. And the newspaper accounts at the time said that he'd been so grief-stricken that he actually went into the grave or the crypt on several occasions to sort of interact with the body. Some accounts said he actually picked it up. So I heard that about 20 years ago, and it just stayed with me all this time. And I, you know, didn't really think I could write it. And then about 2012, I just decided that, you know, if it had been on my mind that long, I should give it a try. So the book is really just that night on which Lincoln comes to this place called Oak Hill Cemetery in Washington, D.C., and he enters the crypt, and then, you know, hilarity ensues.
Now, you're not known to be a religious writer, but what is a bardo?
Well, bardo is a Tibetan word that means transitional state. So we're in one right now, you know, a transition between birth and death. And there are several others, but the book is concerned with the transition between the zone between the moment of your death and then whatever comes next, which in the Tibetan tradition would be, of course, reincarnation, but if you're a Christian, it might be heaven or hell. So bardo kind of means that, and then I also took it to mean, you know, Lincoln himself was in a transition. He had to sort of quickly go from being a grieving father back to being a kind of active president. So the night is sort of almost like a, you know, for him, a chance to sort of take a breath and try to get back into the real world and out of that graveyard.
And the structure of the book, it's almost like you've invented a new form, and it hasn't been written, it's been crafted almost. Tell us about how you decided on that structure.
Yeah, that's a great question. I wouldn't say decided, unless decided was defined as, you know, kind of messing around for 3 or 4 months or maybe even a year. I think... for me, I tried this book in a more traditional way many years ago, kind of a standard third-person narration, and it just didn't have any life in it, you know. And I mostly write short stories, and the one thing I learned is if it's boring for me, it's going to be boring for the reader. So, or, you know, Flannery O'Connor, this great American writer, said once, a person can choose what he writes, but he can't choose what he makes live. So for me, the compositional method is always to just try to find a way to tell the story that makes me happy and makes me maybe confused and excited. So the short version is this was just a product of mucking around trying to find a way to tell the story that was interesting to me. And in the end, the solution was to let it be this kind of chorus of monologues, partly, I think, because, you know, in a sense, to me, that's the truest version of human life is bunch of monologues. You know, if I look out the window here in London, there's 40 or 50 people walking by. The God's eye view of that is actually just 40 inner monologues, you know, at once. Sometimes they contradict each other. Sometimes they don't seem to even be observing the same reality. But it was just an exciting way for me to tell a story. It almost looks like a screenplay, some people have said, or a theatrical script.
Yeah, it'd be interesting to see the Braille version to see how it's translated to... a tactile form, but it certainly doesn't. Well, the audio version couldn't be narrated by just one person, could it?
Well, that was the plan, and I just was so terrified of that because I can only do maybe 2 or 3 distinct voices. You know, I can do a guy from Brooklyn and, you know, a southern voice and a duck or something like that. So I didn't want to do it. So we had this wonderful young woman named Kelly Gilday in Los Angeles had the idea that maybe we could enlist actors, and she actually went off and made a spreadsheet, and she came back on the phone and said, well, we'll need 166 people. I said, well, can we get that? She said, well, we can try. So we got some really wonderful professional actors, and then some voice actors, and then some people from Random House, and my agent, and then we got my family members, and so we just barely made the 166, but there's not a single double voice on the tape. So in other words, every voice that's in the book is represented by a distinct actor in the audiobook.
And would we know some of the actors who are involved?
Yes, I think Ben Stiller, Susan Sarandon, Don Cheadle, Miranda July, Nick Offerman and Megan Mullally, and then David Sedaris plays one of the main parts. So there's quite a list, probably I would say 20 or 30 very famous actors are kind of headlining.
And they all recorded their lines individually.
That's right. They were never in the same... No, none of us were in the studio at the same time. And I think they ended up using, I think she told me 11 different locations. She would Skype, you know, you could go to Minneapolis and Skype in, and my parents went to New Orleans and Skyped in. So it was a Herculean effort, but not by me. Someone else did it all.
Have you read the audio versions of your previous work?
Well, I had 10th of December, and then I think I did one other version. I did two other books. I didn't get through the whole catalog yet, but yeah, 10th of December was kind of the most highly produced one.
And when you're actually writing, is hearing it out loud, even internally, important to the writing process?
It's very important. I'm from Chicago, and for me, the kind of entrance into writing was to understand it as a form of performance. So when we were kids, we did a lot of kind of, you know, improvising and impersonating and that kind of thing. So I had a long time in my life when I was younger where I couldn't figure out how to write, really. I had a little bit of a false version of how to do it. But as soon as I thought, oh, yeah, it's just a performance, then it was easy. I don't usually read, well, as you say, internally is more correct. I don't read aloud. You know, there's that little voice in your head that is a little actually more subtle than your speaking voice, you know, and can get into different registers and do different accents. So that voice is very active for me. So I tend to write, and then as I'm reading, I'm hearing that voice in my mind and adjusting the text to match the voice and so on. And then also, I've been, you know, when I go to colleges or I travel, I do, I try to develop performance versions of the stories where I learn to do the voices as well as I can and then kind of go back and forth to make it lively for the audience.
Now, let's know, you said you wrote short stories. You're described as the master of the short story. So it's a missed opportunity if I don't ask you this. RNIB have a writing competition each year. What are some top tips you would give to people who are potentially thinking about entering that competition?
Sure. Well, that's a great question. I think for me, the big leap forward was when I realized that a short story is not necessarily... how would I say it? It's a strange little machine that we make. It's almost like a song or a poem. It has a resemblance to real life, but it isn't necessarily a linear representation of real life. So, or the other comparison would be to a joke. You know, a joke often doesn't have much to do with real life. It doesn't. It isn't. You know, it's more compressed and it's sillier. But when you're telling the joke, you're really concentrating on the last moment. You know, when you get to the punchline, if the person laughs, then you win, and if they don't, then you lose. So the story is a very similar medium, actually. There's usually one moment in the story that's kind of the payoff moment, and nothing else really matters except for that payoff. So to me, it was very useful to think of it as a kind of a machine, a strange little device that's there to, you know, to create human emotion. The other more quotidian thing would be just that most of the story writers I know who are good, they just do a lot of revision. You know, it's not the case that they just blur something out, but you do blur something out, and then you go back to it again and again and again and try to find what it is really trying to say to you. And that's just a kind of a, you know, a sweat equity sort of a thing. You're really doing hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of rewrites to try to let the story talk to you directly.
How many times did you go back to and rewrite Lincoln and the Bardo?
It would be hard to count. It was a 4-year effort, and every section was rewritten, you know, at least dozens of times, and then whole sections were taken out and put back in, and things were moved around. And so it was kind of a, you know, I'm sure thousands of drafts. I like that the model of writing that is, you know, kind of led by iteration. So you keep coming back to it every day, and gradually it changes shape into what you like. The example I always use is if you had a hotel room, or let's say that I gave you an apartment, I bought it for you and gave it to you, and I furnished it nicely. Although that would be a nice gesture, you would go into the apartment and you wouldn't feel at home. This isn't your style. So revising is like if I let you, you know, every day for 3 years, take out one thing that I bought for you and exchange it for something that you like better. You know, all the pictures, all the knickknacks, the blankets, everything in the house. After that 3 years, the place would have you in every cranny. You know, you would have totally infused that room with yourself. Rewriting is like that. You know, you throw down a first draft. That's kind of like that initial apartment. But then every day when you come back, thing starts to really have your essence in it. And I, for me anyway, that I can't do that unless I work on something for years and years over and over.
George Sanders, thank you so much for joining me today on RNIB Connect Radio.
It's such a pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Thanks to Robert and to George Saunders. You're listening to a special Read On Booker Prize retrospective, featuring the winners from the last 6 years. In 2016, Paul Beattie made history by becoming the first American author to win the Booker Prize. Before we hear Robert's interview with him, here's a clip from his book, The Sellout, narrated by Prentice Oniemi.
I stood in front of the primate cage listening to a woman marvel at how presidential the 400-pound gorilla looked, sitting astride a shorn oaken limb, keeping a watchful eye over his caged brood. When her boyfriend, his finger tapping the informational placard, pointed out the presidential silverback's name coincidentally was Baraka, the woman laughed aloud, until she saw me, the other 400-pound gorilla in the room, stuffing something that might have been the last of a big stick popsicle or a Chiquita banana in my mouth. Then she became disconsolate, crying and apologizing for having spoken her mind and my having been born. "Some of my best friends are monkeys," she said accidentally. It was my turn to laugh.
That was Prentice Oniemi reading from Paul Beattie's Booker shortlisted book, The Sellout. He joined me on the line and told me about the book.
That's a quirky little book about a guy who's from a town that's disappeared off the map in Southern California, a little town outside of Los Angeles. And he decides to put the town back on a map, him and a weird ex-child star actor friend of his, and they decide to put the town on the map by reinstituting racial segregation.
Now, is it hard? It's a very funny book. Is it hard to be funny about that?
Nah, I don't know. I just write the way I write, and usually it comes out humorous at some level. It's just how I think about things and how I tend to put them down on the page. So, I mean, the writing part is hard. I mean, it's extremely hard, but I don't know. The jokes just come, you know, and whenever they come, that's when I put them in there.
Now, it's pretty new that American authors are eligible for the Booker Prize. Do you think it translates to a British audience?
I mean, I think the book, for me, does feel really American, which is not something I think about the stuff that I write very often, but it does feel really American. But as far as I can tell, there's some resonation here, and so I think that's good. I mean, that's translating for some folks, for sure. So, and apparently with the Man Booker people, so I'm deeply thankful for that.
Now, one thing we don't get as a blind or partially sighted reader is the cover. How does the cover reflect the book?
That's an interesting question. So the cover is something called a lawn jockey, which is like out of this old tradition of like during slavery and like immediately after slavery, like race jockeys in America were usually black men. And so people started having these little lawn jockeys in front of their houses. And at some time, I guess probably in the 50s, 60s, 70s, those things just became kind of racist iconography.
Mm.
And so now you still see them, but they're never black, or very, very rarely they'll be white. You know, it's just like a guy in a racing kit holding a lantern. They'll be about like maybe 2 to 3 feet high. And yeah, they're just some kind of weird thing. And at some level, it just, if you had one of those outside of your house, it just said something about your cultural attitudes, I guess, so they're out of fashion.
I understood where she was coming from. This whole city's a Freudian slip of the tongue, a concrete hard-on for America's deeds and misdeeds. Slavery, Manifest Destiny, Laverne and Shirley, standing by idly while Germany tried to kill every Jew in Europe. Why, some of my best friends are the Museum of African Art, the Holocaust Museum, the Museum of the American Indian, the National Museum of Women and the Arts, and furthermore, I'll have you know my sister's daughter is married to an orangutan.
Another clip of The Sellout, read there by Prentice Oniemi. And you haven't heard the audio version, so you don't know how the book translates into audio.
I couldn't tell you. I mean, I think, I think there's an audio version in the States, which I just haven't listened to, because, you know, the book sounds a certain way in my head. I just kind of don't want to hear it sound differently. Or even have it sound better than it does in my head. That would be hard to cope with. I don't know. What's funny is, like, there's a lot of weird bits in the book. Like, there's a map in the book and some charts and some little kind of things. So I'm wondering how they do that in terms of audio. Like, if they just skip that or if they try to... I don't know. That's interesting. I mean, I think, you know, if I think about it, I'm sure a lot of the topics and themes covered in the book are familiar to British readers, you know, whether they're very American or not, you know. I don't think that it's stuff that just is completely unrelatable. I'd be surprised.
Now, where were you when you heard the news that you were on the shortlist?
That's a good question. I was probably at home, I think, sifting through my emails. I think that's how I found out my publisher told me.
And we've heard from publishers, certainly here, that it goes a bit crazy when you're nominated. Was it the same over there?
I think so. I mean, it's a fairly small house. But I feel like apparently they've been through the process already, so they were not prepared for it, but I think they were able to deal with it. But, you know, they seem excited, and they're pleased, I'm pleased. And but, yeah, I mean, it's a good problem to have, I think.
Another nice problem, I suppose, coming up is that you'll have lots of live events. How comfortable are you reading it in public?
I'm okay. I don't like reading particularly, but I'm okay. I get through it, and I usually end up reading really fast and trying to get it over with. But usually it's fine.
Because the amount of jokes in it and the delivery in some of it does, it would lend itself to a stand-up show. And, yeah. and stand-up comedy does come into the novel at some point as well.
Yeah, you know, it's funny now that you think about it. I don't talk about this very often, but, you know, I think this is a guess, I'm not sure, but I think a large part depends on, for me, what I've noticed, it depends on who's in the audience. And, you know, like, I mean, there's a lot of sensitive or things that people find sensitive in the book, you know, some of the jokes. And so I think there can be some feelings of guilt when you're in public. Like, I think sometimes people are a little afraid to laugh at certain parts or, like, waiting for me to laugh to give them permission that it's okay to laugh. And so that part can be a little strange, I think.
So the color of the audience would affect the
Yeah, I think it's color. I don't think it's just color. I think it's also, for me, I've found, like, geographically it depended where I was, what happened in the news the day before, you know, the generation of the audience, older, younger, you know. But, yeah, it's just different.
And finally, did you start writing this before the current rise of Donald Trump?
Oh, yeah. I mean, it took me almost 5 years to write this book. And the book's been done for probably close to 3 years, I bet. And
yet it's perhaps more appropriate given the current political situation
now.
I don't
think, for me, from my perspective, it's not more appropriate. It was appropriate then, it's appropriate now. And, you know, I think odds are it's going to be appropriate tomorrow, you know, unfortunately.
All it takes is a day trip through Georgetown and Chinatown. A slow saunter past the White House, Phoenix House, Blair House, and the local crack house for the message to become abundantly clear. Be it ancient Rome or modern-day America, you're either citizen or slave, lion or Jew, guilty or innocent, comfortable or uncomfortable. And here in the Supreme Court of the United States of America, if between the handcuffs and the slipperiness of this chair's leather upholstery, the only way I can keep from spilling my ass ignominiously onto the goddamn floor is to lean back until I'm reclined at an angle just short of detention room nonchalance, but definitely well past courtroom contempt.
The sellout is available wherever books are sold. It's also available from RNIB in audio, in giant print, and in braille. And Paul Beattie, thanks so much for joining me today on RNIB Connect Radio.
Thanks for having me.
That was the 2016 Booker Prize winner, Paul Beattie. And in 2015, it was
Marlon James with his book, A Brief History of Seven Killings.
We see and wait. Two men bring guns to the ghetto. One man show me how to use it. But ghetto people used to kill each other long before that. With anything we could find. Stick, machete, knife, ice pick, soda bottle. Kill for food, kill for money. Sometimes a man get killed because he look at another man in a way that he didn't like. And killing don't need no reason. This is ghetto. Reason is for rich people. We have madness.
A clip from A Brief History of Seven Killings by Marlon James. Marlon joined me on the line and told me about the book.
A Brief History of Seven Killings is loosely based on the assassination attempt on Bob Marley in 1976. And it was me trying to answer what happened to the men. Well, they're really boys. What happened to the boys that tried to kill him? They kind of vanished from, you know, vanished from the landscape pretty much soon afterwards. And I was always interested in what happened to them. Jamaica has hundreds and hundreds of lost boys. And these were the seven that I became really fascinated with. It. Were they really lost? Did they disappear? Who disappeared them? And in looking at it, it was also my way, my device to figure out the 1970s. The 1970s in Jamaica, we had just, it was 10 years after independence from Britain, but we were caught up in the Cold War. Our economy was in shambles. There was so much violence, and I wanted to try to make sense of all of that.
What age were you when this was actually happening?
I was 6.
So what kind of awareness did you have at the time?
My experience of the 70s is totally different from my parents. For me, the 70s was a world of wonder. It was a world of TV being on in the day. It was Sesame Street. It was all these new American foods. In a bigger sense, it was the United States replacing the United Kingdom as our primary cultural and social influence. And my childhood was, you know, persuading your parents to buy you a cool bicycle. So it wasn't, and my parents were very good. I mean, helps that they were both at one time police. But they were very good at keeping us away from most of that. So growing up, becoming an adult and being aware of the world as an adult, I suddenly realized there was a whole 70s. There was an entire decade that I had no idea of what really happened. So in some ways, it's trying to reclaim that past that I was a part of, but it turns out there are 100 different kinds of past.
Now, the book is told by multiple narrators, and we know there's an audio version of it. Do you think it's one of these books that's better if you listen to rather than read?
That's a good question, because I think even when you're reading, you're listening to it. One, because I'm very much, and it's my second novel that's pretty much told all by voice. And there's something about the orality of literature that I've always liked. It's like they did a new translation of the Torah, and you can tell the person remembered that the original five books were written to be spoken, people to be listened to, not to be read, and that changes everything. And so to me, even when it's written, to me, I more imagine somebody listening to it than reading it. So in that sense, not just the audiobooks make sense. But it also, you know, we're doing a TV script, and much of the lines remain the same, because voice is very important to me, dialogue is very important to me. So I knew the audio would be very important.
Are you hearing the voices in your head as you're writing them down?
Yeah, and I think you have to. I can tell when a writer doesn't. this is not every writer is a dialogue guy, and you don't have to be. But it's very important for me that I have a sense that the characters are participating in their own story. And so far, it doesn't always have to be the case, but so far for me, it means them telling it. So I do hear their voices. And when I was listening to the auditions for the audio tape, that's what I listened for, what clicked, what sounds closest to what I had in my head.
Mm. So you actually got to choose the voices?
I did get to choose the voices. They sent me a bunch of, quite a few audio samples of different performers. Some with an understanding of Jamaican, some which didn't sound Jamaican at all. It sounded African. I think they thought that could pass. So it's like, no, they have to sound, the Americans have to sound American and the Jamaicans have to sound Jamaican.
Did you think about doing one of the voices yourself at all?
No. I've never voiced, I have 3 audiobooks now and I've never voiced them. Funny enough, my previous 2 audiobooks were voiced by a woman. Yeah, and this was multiple voices, but because it's more, when you're doing an audiobook, I think you're not just reading, you're acting.
But you're also trying not to do a performance of the book. There's a very fine line, I think.
But I think it also, again, depends on how vivid a world you want to paint. Because I teach creative writing, and one of the things that I realize certainly with beginning writers is there's an over reliance on sight as a sensory detail. So, like, I would say, I'll walk into the class and go, "What did 9/11 smell like?" There's too much of an over reliance on sight detail, I find, because it's the first thing you think of. But Azir Nafisi, for example, reading Lalita in Tehran, uses a lot of sound. An explosion is not something they see. An explosion is a rumble that they hear in the basement and a noise. And only when they run upstairs, they see smoke. So you don't even see the explosion, you feel it. And that was also very important to me. There's a scene at the beginning of the book where an American journalist is talking about the ghetto in Kingston, and he only uses smell. So, which is not to say sight and visual details aren't important, but there's a lot more to the sensory experience of a scene in a novel than that. And that was very, very important to me.
Madness that make you follow a man in a suit down King Street, where poor people never go, and watch him throw a sandwich, chicken. You smell it and you wonder how people can be so rich that they use chicken for just to put between sauce of bread. And you pass the garbage and see it, still in a file, and still fresh, not brown with the other garbage and no fly on it yet. And you think, maybe, and you think yes, and you think you have to, just to see what chicken tastes like with no bone. But you say you're not no madman, and the madness in you is not crazy people madness, but angry madness. Because you know the man threw it away because he wants you to see. And you promise yourself that one day Rude Boy gonna start walking with a knife.
A Brief History of Seven Killings by Marlon James is available in Braille, in giant print, and as a talking book. For more information, head to www.rnib.org.uk.
And you can call the helpline on 0303 123 9999. That number again, 0303 123 9999.
Thanks to a special arrangement with the Booker Foundation, all of the books in the shortlist for all the years featured are available in audio from RNIB.
The Booker Prize recognises the best in fiction written in the English language, and it's open to authors writing in English from all over the world. In 2014, it was won by Australian author Richard Flanagan for his novel The Narrow Road to the Deep North. He told Robert Kirkwood about the book.
It's a love story, I guess, which spans about 70 years of one man's life, from the early 20th century through to the 1990s, and has as its centre one day in a prisoner of war camp on the Death Railway in Thailand in 1943. But I guess it's really a story about love and death. All the great verities, really. It centres on a character called Dorrigo Evans, who's a surgeon who ends up being the leader of a group of POWs, but only because that's what the other men expect of him. He feels himself to be something of a fraud and a sham. And after the war, he's celebrated as a war hero, and he feels ever more false about the accolades that are heaped on him.
Now, tell us about your personal experience of the railway, though.
Well, my father was a survivor of the Death Railway and of being a Japanese prisoner of war for 3.5 years. I guess I grew up as a child of the Death Railway, and I absorbed much, I was one of six, as did my brothers and sisters, and you end up carrying strange things within you. And I realised at a certain point that I would have to write a book about those things and try and divine what they meant. And that meant I would have to do it as a novel. The novel's not a fictionalised account of my father's experience, because to come to some understanding of it, to try and understand what it was, I needed to invent a story. And so the characters and the situations are different, although they're informed by my father's experience.
Before you were a novelist, in fact, when you were a child, how aware of your father's past were you?
Well, I always knew he was a prisoner of war, a Japanese prisoner of war. I mean, the book's dedicated to prisoner Sambiyaka Sanchigo, which was his Japanese prison number, 335. I learned to count to 10 in Japanese very early on. It was never anything hidden or unsaid. He was unlike many returned ex-POWs who didn't talk about it at all, which seems to have been very common. But I think in truth he talked about it in a certain way, and it was, you know, there were stories of compassion and camaraderie, and that they were tales leavened with a certain pity, but also with great humour. He didn't like what he called the horror stories, but I think when you look at it, you have to admit it was a horrific circumstance that these men found themselves in, working on the death railway, which was, you know, one of the great war crimes of the Second World War. Over a quarter of a million slave labourers building this railway, of whom over 100,000 perished. More corpses than there are words in my book. More corpses than the bomb created at Hiroshima. It was a terrible thing.
Now, knowing what your father went through, was it hard to write the Japanese characters in the book with humanity and sort of sympathy as well?
Well, a lot of people ask me this, Robert, but in truth, perhaps the monsters are closer to us, you know. They weren't so hard, because I think it's always convenient to think evil wears the face of another, but in the end, murder, hate, evil, these things are buried as deeply within the human breast, perhaps even more deeply than love, kindness, goodness. And the truth is, perhaps those things are terribly entwined and difficult to disentangle. And the great crimes of the last 100 years have so often been done not by wicked men or women, but by the very best of people who believe they were, that their sense of their own goodness demanded they do things for some supranational or super religious or super political idea of goodness. And at that point, their lives oddly ended up in service of some of the great crimes of our age. That led me to view the Japanese characters not as people very removed from me, but as people very close. I suppose we have to be honest and admit that evil is the face we see in the mirror as much as also as love is.
How was your real-life meeting with the equivalent of your character, Commander Nakamura, with the lizard?
Well, I near the end of the writing of the novel, I went to Japan and I tracked down some of the surviving guards of the death railway, and because it was such a vast project, I didn't expect to meet anyone who'd been at my father's camp, but as it turned out, I met three or four of them, including one who'd been the Ivan the Terrible of the camp, a man known to the Australians as the Lizard. And that was a very strange meeting, because I only realised about 5 minutes before I arrived at this meeting in a taxi office in outer suburban Tokyo that this man was in fact the Lizard. He'd changed his name back to his original Korean name rather than the Japanese name that I knew him as. The Lizard, you know, a man who was sentenced to death for war crimes at war's end, had it commuted to a life sentence and then was released in the general amnesty in 56, was now a genial, gentle and gracious old man who endeavoured as best he could to answer my questions over an hour and a half or so. And finally, for reasons I still don't fully understand, I asked him if he would slap me. Slapping was the principal form of punishment in the POW camps, or certainly the most immediate and the most common, a very violent and continuous slapping. And he thought this rightly was a very curious request, but finally he agreed and we stood up. And he knew how to slap, you know. He positioned his body, you know, to get maximum effect. He cupped his hands. He slapped me three times, and on the third slap, the whole room began to sway and shudder and rock. And I thought I was going mad. But in fact, what was happening was that a 7.3 Richter scale earthquake had just hit Tokyo. And as this room swam up and down, I looked at this frightened old man, and I realised wherever evil was, it wasn't in that room with us.
Did your father know about his release in 56, and how did he feel about that?
My father knew he'd escaped punishment. Well, he had a certain period in jail, I guess. He didn't know he was still alive. When I returned to Australia, I told him that I'd met several prison guards, including the Lizard, and that all of them. I said that I didn't think they felt guilt, and I don't think they did. I think guilt is a higher concept, and it's difficult in Japan to feel guilt for many people when the Allies kept the Emperor there as the at the apex of Japanese society, when all these people felt that all their acts were an expression of the Emperor's will, and that the Emperor was this deity who fully expressed the Japanese spirit. But I think they felt something more fundamental, and that was a certain shame, a deep shame. And all of them asked me to passed on apologies for me to pass on to my father. They all said they were sorry for what he and his fellow Australian soldiers had experienced.
Mm.
So I told my father that when I returned, and he was very old by then. He was 98, but his memory was still very good, and his mind was still very sharp. But later that day, he lost all memory of his time in the prisoner of war camps. That was a strange thing, because he retained all memory of life before the war and immediately after the war, and of the war itself, but not of being a POW. And it was, as my sister said, as if he were finally free.
Is the book going to be released in Japan?
Yeah, it will be released in Japan. My books have always been published there, and they have a good following there, and my Japanese translator was a great help to me in writing the book. I think we make a mistake thinking that Japanese people were closed to these stories. It is the case that they haven't been exposed to them that much. But, you know, I encountered great kindness and generosity and interest as I travelled through Japan. And my translator feels, as do other people I know in writing and publishing in Japan, that the book will be well received.
Now, as I said, your book's now available in Braille and in giant print and in audio for everyone. Is it important to you that your book is accessible?
Oh, yeah, completely. That's why I thought it was very sweet when you said that at the beginning, and I hadn't realised. Yeah, books are the great democratic art form, you know. So sometimes you're doing signings and people say, I haven't got a copy of your book, I borrowed it. I'm very sorry to say I borrowed it from a library. But I think that's a beautiful thing, you know, because most art requires you to live in a great centre and have access to money. You need a lot of money to see theatre, to see opera, and to see a movie. The great art galleries are in the great cities, and to get to them you need money. The books are the great democratic art form. They're available everywhere, the best of them. You can get them for nothing from a library, or people will lend them to you because they're not really worth anything much, not like a great painting or something like that. And the 1/1,000,000th paperback version, or the Braille version, or the print handicap version of my book or of a great book is just as valid, just as original, just as unique as the very first edition, the very first, the manuscript as it left the writer's hand. So, I think the more books available to the more people, the better the world is, because novels are one of the great human inventions. It's one of the great traditions we have of understanding ourselves spiritually, intellectually, aesthetically. And I think it's always not just a beautiful thing, but a necessary, important thing that they be available to ever more people. I mean, the rise of democracy, the rise of a world that becomes a better place is linked with the rise of people being able to read.
In his old age, Dorrigo Evans never knew if he had read this or had himself made it up. Made up, mixed up, and broken down. Relentlessly broken down. Rock to gravel to dust to mud to rock. And so the world goes, as his mother used to say when he demanded reasons or explanation as to how the world got to be this way or that. The world is, she would say. It just is, boy.
Richard Flanagan narrating the audio version of his Booker Prize-winning novel, The Narrow Road to the Deep North. You're listening to Read On, the audiobook show recorded at the RNIB Talking Book Studios. We're having a listen back to some interviews with the previous winners of the Booker Prize. And finally today, the winner from 2013. Here's Robert chatting to Eleanor Catton.
Now, I'm aware of the enormity of this question and the amount of levels that we will talk about in a moment, but initially, tell us about the book.
Well, from the very beginning of writing it, really, I've been describing it as an astrological murder mystery, which I suppose speaks to both halves of the book. Both that it's kind of on the ground level, it's a pretty much straightforward classic adventure story murder mystery in which you know, various people disappear and are blackmailing other people and so on and so forth. On the other side of the coin, the book is a kind of a structural experiment, I suppose, in the sense that the action of the book, the plot of the book, has been patterned on the movement of, or the apparent movement, I should say, of the seven planets, the seven astrological planets, through the 12 signs of the zodiac over the course of a calendar year.
The book is illustrated with these astrological charts, and blind and partially sighted people won't get those in the book. Are they needed for the plot?
No, I wouldn't say so, necessarily. Yeah, the way that the book is structured is that there are 12 parts, and each of the 12 parts takes place on a single day, spaced out around a single year. So in astrological terms, what that means is that the sun is in a different sign of the zodiac for each of the 12 parts. And just prior to every the beginning of every part, there is a horoscope, just a circular chart divided into 12, very much like the face of a clock, which shows the position of each of the seven planets by their astrological sigil. It's really just as a kind of a mental map, I suppose, to prime the reader to see who's moved, who's switched places, you know, who's kind of moved, and how the heavens have changed. But I think that it's not necessarily integral to understanding the definitely not understanding the or following the plot. It's more of a kind of a decorative element of the book, I suppose.
Just a clue to see which characters are in ascendance.
Right, exactly. Yeah.
Do you believe in astrology yourself?
Well, I would say that maybe believe is the wrong verb to use, but I have a lot of respect for it. I gained a lot of respect for it, I would say, in terms of over the course of researching the book. I think that before I'd done any kind of decent research into it as a subject, I'd always just assumed that it was I don't know, some sort of rather feeble you know, version of self-help, you know, that was always kind of presented in the newspapers in a very watered down kind of even kind of pathetic kind of a way. And the more that I studied it, the more that I realized how incredibly culturally and historically rich it is as a system. You know, it wasn't very long ago that astrology and astronomy, for example, were indistinguishable from one another. And you know, kings and world leaders have had resident astrologers for many years and across many different cultures. So there's definitely a lot there to be wondered at and to be investigated.
The 12 men congregated in the smoking room of the Crown Hotel gave the impression of a party accidentally met. From the variety of their comportment and dress, frock coats, tailcoats, Norfolk jackets with buttons of horn, yellow moleskin, cambric and twill, they might have been 12 strangers on a railway car, each bound for a separate quarter of a city that possessed fog and tides enough to divide them. Indeed, the studied isolation of each man as he pored over his paper, or leant forward to tap his ashes into the grate, or placed the splay of his hand upon the bays to take his shot at billiards, conspired to form the very type of bodily silence that occurs late in the evening on a public railway. Deadened here not by the slur and clunk of the coaches, but by the fat clatter of the rain.
Now, one thing we won't get is the cover. I believe you came across that image accidentally in a library.
Oh, yes. Oh, so this is the end papers of the book, of the hardback, actually. This isn't in the paperback.
Hmm.
But my mum found an old print. It's actually from the 1870s, so it's about maybe 8 years after my book is set. And it's a print of a little etching that was made of the town of Hokitika, which this is the gold rush town in which the novel is set. And I just immediately loved it. It's what the print shows is the perspective on the west coast of the South Island of New Zealand from the ocean. So you're looking up this very wide, kind of flat-bottomed river towards the mountains. And in the foreground, you have all of the little false fronts of the kind of shanty houses and a couple of figures walking along the road in the extreme foreground. So it's quite a lovely print in that it shows the both the kind of the claustrophobia of the setting there, but also the extreme expansiveness with the kind of the sea giving way to the hills giving way to the mountains behind.
The plot, using astrology, now I'm going to try and phrase this question in a way that I can understand, never mind you. Astrology sort of preordains your future, but the way you wrote, you didn't know how it was going to end when you were writing it.
No, that's true. I mean, I think that, you know, this is just part and parcel with how I work as a fiction writer. I feel that it's very, very important not to be able to see too far ahead, because if you do, as the writer, what ends up happening is that you start losing touch with what your reader is experiencing, because obviously they can't see ahead.
Mm.
And so if you're writing too knowingly, if you're kind of speeding up to get to the thing that you already know you're going to implant in 10 pages time, there's a very good chance that your experience and the reader's experience will become divorced in a way that might end up kind of harming the overall effect of the book. So I definitely started blindly in that way, kind of knowing the general shape of what I wanted to do. I wanted to write a murder mystery. I wanted to have a kind of quite intensely plotted book with lots of, double blinds and people blackmailing people who end up getting blackmailed themselves and so on and so forth. But for all of that, I wasn't really sure exactly what would happen.
Mm.
And the way that the stars or the astrological scaffolding of the book played into that was, curiously enough, actually, I think, to my advantage, in the sense that I was working with archetypes. Essentially, what the zodiac is a system of archetypes with not only 12 essential principles, which are embodied in my book in 12 men who each kind of are typical of one of the signs of the zodiac, but also of there are 7 moving parts, which are the 7 planets, and each of these parts bring an influence to bear upon the principle of the sign, if that makes sense. So, for example, I started the book on a particular day in January of 1866, because I really liked what was happening in the stars, in the heavens at that time. And the first chapter of the book is called Mercury in Sagittarius, because at that time Mercury was in fact in Sagittarius when seen from the perspective of the Hokitika goldfields. And when I started thinking about how to begin the book, I looked at what happens when you put Mercury together with Sagittarius, when those two elements combine in a person's chart.
Hmm.
And what I discovered was that, Mercury, the planet that governs communication and reason and logic and words in a lot of ways, is coming into contact with Sagittarius as this principle of adventure and abandon, and enthusiasm. And when these two elements came together, what you got was the beginning of a story, so the beginning of somebody telling a story. So I thought, all right, I'll have somebody walking into a bar, which is how the book begins, and sitting down, and somebody begins to tell him a story, and that's how I'll kind of make sense of those elements. So it was kind of like that all the way along. I had these little archetypes that were partial pictures, and I just had to think for a while until I could figure out how to make use of them in the context of the story.
Does that help your enjoyment when you're writing it? Because part of you is almost thinking, I wonder what's going to happen next.
Oh, for sure. Yeah, no, I think that it's crucial, actually, to remain in a state as a writer where you're surprising yourself. Because if you're not surprising yourself, and if you're not having fun yourself, I mean, how can you expect somebody to be having fun or to be being surprised, you know, on their part?
Now, we are on RNIB's Insight Radio. So how important is it for you that your books are accessible to everyone, no matter what their sight condition?
Oh, I mean, I think that's hugely important. You know, I haven't yet talked with anybody actually who has listened to the book rather than read it, and I'd be quite curious to hear how the experience is different. But I think it's a wonderful initiative.
Such was the perception of Mr. Walter Moody, from where he stood in the doorway with his hand upon the frame. He was innocent of having disturbed any kind of private conference, for the speakers had ceased when they heard his tread in the passage. By the time he opened the door, each of the 12 men had resumed his occupation, rather haphazardly on the part of the billiard players, for they had forgotten their places, with such a careful show of absorption that no one even glanced up when he stepped into the room.
So, Eleanor Catton, author of The Luminaries, thank you so much for joining me today on RNIB Connect Radio.
Thanks very much, it was really fun.
Thanks, Robert. A lot of those interviews were before my time, but I'm sure you'll interview the winner again this year.
Well, here's hoping, but since you've said that it's always the one I interview last, I've put money on them the last 2 years and lost both times.
And we can assume that the author who won't give us an interview might also stand a chance this year as well.
Well, coming up in future editions of Read On, in the run-up to the winner of this year's Booker Prize, fingers crossed we'll have the entire shortlist on the show, including Salman Rushdie and Margaret Atwood.
So keep your fingers crossed, and we better start reading. Alas, that's all we've got time for this week. My thanks to all the guests and to Robert. And thanks to you for listening. Farewell until next week, and don't forget to read on.